This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is producing, and the number to call, and you'll hear her voice first, is 877-217-5757. Emails are to talk@talklouisiana.org. And the libertarian lawyer Mike Wolf is in the house. He has logged 40 or 50 years on the political scene in Louisiana. And like many others, we are amazed at the ascension to power in Washington of one Mike Johnson, the Baptist from Bossier City and Captain Shreve and Benton, Louisiana. He is now the person in charge, and he was forced yesterday to rely on Democratic votes to pass legislation to keep federal funding flowing into early 2024 after scores of Republicans opposed his plan to avert a government shutdown at the end of the week, and he got the votes. Almost all Democrats and majority of Republicans overcame the opposition of GOP conservatives to approve the bill under special expedited procedures that required a supermajority. That approach, which was hatched by Speaker Johnson in the first week as Speaker, amounted to a gamble that a substantial number of Democrats would rally to pass a package that Mike Johnson's own members were unwilling to back. The vote was 336 to 95. In the end, 209 Democrats and 127 Republicans passed the bill. And it is a remarkable maneuver by Mike Johnson, who's a newbie. Many thought he was out of his league. He had never been a chair of a House committee. He's only been there for 6 years. So he is now making his voice and his abilities known. And in the early going, Mike Wolf, this is a remarkable development. And hats off to Speaker Johnson. What are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, it looks like he's managed to to achieve something significant legislatively in passing this continuing resolution, but it's exactly what McCarthy did that got him thrown out of the speaker's position. So people in the fiscal conservatives, the serious fiscal conservatives in the Republican Party, are calling hypocrisy on it. They're saying that, you know, that Johnson's doing the same thing McCarthy did, but at least it's going to pass the Senate, it seems, right now. So we'll have a continuing resolution that will continue spending at last year's level until February.
Well, the Speaker McCarthy was not well liked by some of the hard right members of his delegation, and yesterday he was accused of elbowing one of them in the back. The guy said he took a kidney shot from Speaker McCarthy, and now Matt Gaetz is going to file some kind of formal complaint. And it appears the Baptist from Bakersfield, former Speaker McCarthy, is still not happy about what happened, Mike.
No, he's not. And that's Burchett from Tennessee. And that's just more of the childishness of the Republican Party. It just shows they can't do their jobs very well. But look, this question of spending, the media calls them hard right conservatives, MAGA Republicans, because they want to reduce federal spending. With a $2 trillion deficit, anyone who doesn't want to reduce federal spending is irresponsible. And that issue is largely ignored by the mass media. So anyway, hats off to the fiscal conservatives on the far right of the Republican Party who think we ought to spend less in fiscal 24 than we did in fiscal 23.
Well, as I mentioned, the deficit has actually gone down under President Joseph Robinette Biden. This year it is going up. The federal budget deficit reached $2.8 trillion in Trump's last year, $2.8 trillion. And then in 2020, the year before, it was $3.1 trillion because of COVID, actually went down a little bit. And then Biden comes along and he gets it down to under $1 trillion, and now it's going back up. It's not to $2 trillion yet, but it's headed that way unless something happens. And you are right that we have, even though Biden's brought it down, he has the second highest deficit on record. And the debt continues to grow. In fact, the debt continues to grow if there's a $10 deficit. The debt is going to grow. But we've got a long way to go. It would take over $100,000 for every man, woman, and child in this country to pay off the U.S. debt. And now we're getting to a level that some people believe is unsustainable. And your thoughts about whether the leadership that's in place now can make it any better, and whether bringing back Donald Trump, who had the hugest deficits of all time and increased our debt by $8 trillion in just 4 years, whether he's the guy to solve this mess. What do you think, Mike Wolf?
Of course he's not, and the Republicans aren't, but they're the only people we've got up there. And right now, the public and the media seem content to keep us limited to these Democrats and Republicans, although 40% of the country is independents, not Democrats or Republicans. But back to this matter of spending, it's not that some people think it's unsustainable. It's that everyone knows it's unsustainable. We can't keep spending at this rate. Interest on the national debt is now about to be 25% of national revenue. Mm-hmm. It's just madness. And they can't stand to reduce spending to last year's level or to cut it 1%. It's just absurd. We'll see what happens. They're going to keep spending. Some things are necessary. If you're in a war, you've got to spend. You've got to borrow money. I think we have to borrow money to help Ukraine, for example. And there are other needs. But, God, it's going to be a hell of a problem. And we'll see what Johnson and the Republicans and the Democrats can manage to accomplish. But budgeting is going to be very, very difficult.
I had this same conversation with Lauren Scott 25 years ago, and that's when Bill Clinton actually balanced the budget. Now, he inherited a record deficit, and it's become a bigger record since then, but he balanced the budget. But over time, he was increasing the debt as well because we didn't have a balanced budget. And so the debt was going up, and he had these bloviators like Rush Limbaugh saying, the debt's going up. Clinton's not doing what he said he would do. Well, the only way you're going to decrease the debt is to have a balanced budget and a surplus. And that's the only way it happens, and it takes time to do that. And these incremental steps have to be made, and right now they're not being made. We are spending, as Jim Nickle would say, like drunken sailors, no doubt about it. But it is not something that started with President Joseph Robinette Biden, and you would think it was, and these same Republicans they didn't have any issue at all, Mike, when Donald Trump was raising the debt ceiling. None at all. Why is it only an issue when Democrats are in office?
Of course not. They're hypocrites. Can you say hypocrite?
Okay.
Republicans are hypocrites.
Well, Democrats can be hypocrites,
too. Of course they are. They're all hypocrites.
Okay, I'm glad you're impressed with our government. James in Lafayette. James, you're on Talk Louisiana. Good morning to you.
Good morning, gentlemen. Listen, both of you, the so-called deficit is just the quantity of U.S. dollars in the economy, the quantity that the government has spent out minus the dollars that extracted in taxes. The national debt, basically the same thing. Neither one of them are in any way a problem, and both of you are promoting an austerity framework that only harms people. Every time that the national debt has attempted to be paid down, it's caused a massive recession.
That did not happen with Bill Clinton. We had massive growth. The stock market grew under him more than any president other than FDR. So that is wrong, but and interest rates, by the way, were high. They're about as high then as they are now. So it can be done, but it has to be done surgically. And of course, you have to tax the rich who have the money to pay the taxes, because if you tax the middle class and the lower class, you're going to end up causing people to spend less and the economy goes down the drain. So it has to be done surgically. But getting back to Lauren Scott, when I was having this conversation with him, I thought he made a point, and this part I do agree with you somewhat, James, is that as people we have debt. We have house notes, we have car notes, we have credit card debt, we have student loan debt, and yet we continue to absorb that debt with the hope and the faith and the confidence that we're going to get out of it with our abilities and our ability to work hard. And ultimately, most people do. Many don't, but most people do. And he said the U.S. government, it's okay to have some debt, but the question is how much debt. It does seem at 25%, James, that we are reaching the tipping point. Mike?
Yes, we are. And James is totally mistaken. I disagree entirely with him to say that the debt is no problem. It's just ridiculous. Let me point out a few things. It's the monetizing of the debt that causes inflation. This is what causes the undue expansion of the money supply through the Fed's balance sheet. That is, they're printing money and just throwing it into the economy to buy securities. and invest in the stock market, backing up corporations and different kinds of entities. It used to just be banks. Now it's corporations too. All this bailout consciousness is ruining us. And just that is the cause of inflation fundamentally, the undue expansion of the money supply relative to production. And we keep doing that because we have to fund our massive deficits and debt. And it's deadly.
On a cheerier note, inflation eased in October and price increases showed encouraging signs of slowing. And so as a result, stocks yesterday rose sharply following a hopeful inflation report. And today the Dow is up again. So maybe there is something good that's in the offing. And as I've stated before, some of the other economic indicators, as far as employment, at a record high in the United States. More people are working in this country now than ever before. More people are working in Louisiana than ever before. And today at 2, we'll hear from Governor John Bel Edwards. But we're back with Mike Wolf after this 89.3 second timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is ready if you're ready to call 877-217-5757. We're spending a bit more time with the godfather of the Libertarian Party, Mike Wolf, who in the old days, when I would talk with him, he's always been a libertarian, but he, at a certain time in his life, he's veered along the political route and changed his mind a few times, but he would be more critical of Democrats than Republicans. But a listener asked, why are you so intense now in your criticism of Republican stalwarts in Congress and in public life? What's the reason, Mike?
Well, because they can't follow the Constitution, and they're trying to turn people into robots and puppets. This idea of causing a religion to rule the state, recombining church and state, it's terrible, and this is what everybody's afraid of Mike Johnson for, because he seems to believe in that, just like the mullahs, just like the Muslims who believe there should be no difference between church and state. You know, that's terrible. People need to learn to think for themselves. That's why we got such a damn mess in Washington, because people can't think for themselves and do what's sensible.
Well, you're getting, I'll give you credit, you're as intense about social issues as you are about fiscal ones, and last week, abortion was a major issue in some red states like Kentucky and Ohio, and Democrats fared well. Is there a movement in the other direction on this issue?
Apparently so, yes. The majority of the people in the country think women ought to be able to make their own decisions about whether to terminate pregnancies. But the Republicans are learning it the hard way. Hopefully they'll learn it a lot more.
Jim on I-12. Jim, good morning. You're on.
Morning, gentlemen. You are correct, as you stated earlier, that the wealthy need to actually pay their taxes, and they're not. And our new Speaker of the House, one of his first things he was wanting to do is cut $90 million from the IRS, which was put in there to help go after the rich who are not paying their taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's incredibly disingenuous on the part of Republicans to claim that, well, they want to reduce the deficit and they won't pay for it because they won't pay the people who pay them.
All right. Jim makes, I think, some valid points. Mike?
Yes, of course. And the biggest move on taxation that the Trump administration did was the so-called Tax Cut and Jobs Act of 2017. And, of course, that was mainly a tax cut for the rich. And the result, the deficit ballooned. It's terrible. You can't keep doing that. But one thing about taxation is that the Democrats and Republicans don't care at all about tax equity. All they care about is tax breaks for their constituents, the particular people that support them. If you simply got rid of all the tax expenditures, all the special breaks that the tax code allows, we'd collect a lot more revenue and we'd have a lot fairer system. And so anyway, the you should not look at just the total tax rate, but the individual taxes. And you should be alert to creating what I call tax equity, that is fairness in taxation. We got to get rid of all the subsidies that we give through the tax system and start having a fair, simple, rational tax system.
On the other big issue, congressional redistricting. Louisiana is front and center, and Judge Shelley Dick has given the legislature until January 15th to come up with a plan. Now, that is a date that has some peril because Jeff Landry takes office January 8th, and presumably the new governor and new legislature would do this, but he has only a week, or has to have a week, to call lawmakers into session, which would mean that would be January 15th. They would have to do it on one day, which might be hard, might not, don't know. But Governor Edwards could call him in right now. I don't think he wants to do that, and today, of course, we'll talk about that with him on his show. But Mike, independent of who does it, it appears that there will be a new configuration. And a question from a listener, and this is, I think, particularly relevant, is that these districts don't necessarily have to be majority black, because they're so-called black opportunity districts, and we've seen five straight mayors of Baton Rouge elected in East Baton Rouge Parish with a white majority, although a very small white majority. And in the same parish, Joe Biden won, Hillary Clinton won, Barack Obama won twice, Foster Campbell won, Mary Landrieu beat Bill Cassidy in his home parish. Baton Rouge is blue, 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 and yet it is still slightly, very slightly, majority white. So let's say the legislature comes up with a district that's 48% black. Will that fly, or is that not good enough? What do you think?
I think it will. Now, the important thing to realize about these decisions, and I've got them right here, the Fifth Circuit decision, the Alabama Supreme Court decision, and Judge Dick's decision. The setting of the date was the Fifth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals, by the way, that said it.
They said it. You're right. January they said 15th. It, not Judge Dick.
Yeah. But anyway, this is the point. Being fair to minority voting groups does not mean abandoning traditional redistricting criteria. The traditional redistricting criteria are that districts should reflect communities of interest. They're communities. That's what a district means. It's a common area. They're geography-based. They're geographical. And you're not supposed to divide parishes, divide cities, divide precincts any more than you have to. The idea is to minimize those things and to keep communities of interest united. Now, those are traditional redistricting principles. The jurisprudence under the Voting Rights Act does not abandon that at all. In fact, it's the starting point. People like the media, you unfortunately, and Mr. Ballard and the governor, keep saying that the law requires that we have the same proportion of black representatives as we have blacks in the population. And that is not the law. In fact, the Voting Rights Act says explicitly nothing in this law allows one to demand proportionality. That's the word they use, the proportion of your participation in the population.
I don't think I've ever said that, but I've implied it, and I don't think it's a bad idea either. I think it can be done. But on the other hand, I think it's fairly apparent that a black candidate can be elected in a white, slightly white majority district. And another reality is that black people generally have for years voted for white candidates, while white voters have rarely voted for black candidates because they usually have had other candidates to choose from. So it is an interesting quandary, and my guess is that the lawmakers will come up with a plan that has a slight majority black district. But where will it be? Will it be Baton Rouge? Will it be Baton Rouge is going to be included. North Baton Rouge is the trigger. Will it be in the Monroe area, or will it be in New Orleans, or will it be in Baton Rouge? How are they going to do it, Mike?
Okay, well, I think it should be geographically based, but the state legislators are terribly influenced by the congressmen. The congressmen, you could say, pull their strings. The congressmen call them up and request that they do such and such, and they jump. Now, but going back to what you were saying, you got to be clear about this. I've said it a bunch of times, if the blacks were spread evenly throughout the state, they'd make a minority in no district. We've got a third of the population black, so you couldn't say we'd have to have two black congressmen. We do have racially polarized voting, but it is not total, as you've been saying. There's crossover voting among the races. But in general, historically, my understanding has been that the blacks are more reluctant to vote for whites than whites to vote for blacks, the opposite of what you said. But that doesn't matter. I want colorblind voting. I want colorblind districts. If you look at the present district map, and this is what the legislators have all agreed on, and when Judge Dick sent it back to him, they did the same thing. three districts are just terrible gerrymanders, the first, the second, and the sixth. You look at Scalise's district. It's just a ridiculous shape. It's got St. Tammany. It's got St. Bernard, Lafourche, and Terrebonne part of it joined in with Metairie. And New Orleans, of course, the segregated second district is a monstrosity, 200 miles of a district. And then the sixth district, it looks like a claw, is ridiculous. And it was forced because of the creation of the segregated second. Going back to segregation in voting districts is just terrible.
We have protected two U.S. Congressmen, Garrett Graves and Steve Scalise. And Troy Carter, a third one.
He's being
protected as well.
Exactly.
And Troy Carter's not happy about having a district that will be a little harder to win in. But if he's doing a good job. But we'll talk more about this because this is going to be the big issue. In the first days of the Landry administration, how are those districts redrawn? And will Governor Landry coax lawmakers into doing it? We'll talk more after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757 and talklouisiana.org. Mike Wolf is in the house, the libertarian lawyer, graduate of Stanford and LSU. And his family was the Wolf Bakery. That's Mike's pedigree. And of course, he came back home and has lived here for much of his life and follows our world with great passion. And on the congressional redistricting, we were talking about the necessity, some believe, for a second black majority district with a population that is essentially one-third in Louisiana. Two out of six is one-third. It makes sense. But Mike is correct that in order to do that, you have to draw lines that bring in the places where blacks live in Louisiana. He made the statement, though, that blacks are more likely to vote for black people than whites are for whites, meaning whites cross over more. But a listener notes accurately that Lindy Boggs represented a majority black district for years in New Orleans, and John Bel Edwards, the governor of Louisiana, when he was a state rep, represented a majority black district in the Louisiana House. So there is more of a tradition of white people representing majority black districts than the other way around, but we are in a new world, and now we have this era in the Deep South, Mississippi and Louisiana in particular, in which whites are basically Republicans and blacks are basically Democrats, and there are more whites than there are blacks. So as of now, Republicans rule the roost when it comes to statewide offices in the Magnolia State and in our state. Bill Huey asked Mike, what is the practical difference between an independent and a libertarian?
A libertarian is a kind of independent, but they're the same thing. Basically, an independent is anyone who's not a Democrat or a Republican. So by definition, libertarians are independents. But you have to ask the individual people, you know, to look at the differences. The libertarians are important because they're a constitutionalist. They're constitutional conservatives. And they are they're free market people who believe in personal liberty and individual responsibility. So I often say it's limited government, free markets, and personal responsibility. But anyway, to show you how it's important in the voting, that's if you have reasonable districts, it's possible to have reasonable candidates and in more opportunity for independent candidates, not just ethnic minorities. And if you have a 200-mile-long district that goes from Scotlandville to New Orleans East, it's very hard for local people to get into the race, an independent. So you're only going to get people who are tightly connected to the major parties. If you have community-based districts, there's more opportunity for independent candidates. Mm-hmm. So it's basically what hopefully the legislature will do, but they probably won't, will be to reexamine the whole pattern of congressional districts. We've got three reasonably shaped districts, roughly, the fifth, the fourth, and the third, and then three horribly shaped ones, the first, the second, and the sixth. They need to make community-based districts, have one based in New Orleans, one based in Baton Rouge, one based in the Bayou area. That's how South Louisiana should be districted, and I personally prefer an I-20 district separating North Louisiana into North and South rather than East and West. You could do it one way or the other.
I like your concept, and with computers now, you can find out quickly whether that is actually a way to do it. Mm-hmm. But if you carve up North Louisiana, you're maybe messing with the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson. So I would say Johnson is probably the safest one of them all. Nobody's going to take his district away from him. But Garrett Graves, over the last few months, has made some moves that I'm sure the incoming governor is not happy about. First, he flirted with running against him. Second, he got Stephen Wagesback, his friend, to get in the race. And then he irritated Steve Scalise and his followers by purportedly not getting fully behind Scalise as Speaker of the House. So Graves is vulnerable for all the wrong reasons, I might add. He should be vulnerable because Baton Rouge should have one district, period. End of story. And Mike, all you got to do is put North Baton Rouge and the rest of the city together, and you can easily draw a black district if you bring in some places like West Baton Rouge and Pointe-Coupee, and you get to the 800,000 votes that are necessary, 800,000 people that are necessary for a congressional district. Where do you think this is going?
No one knows whether it's going to be Judge Dick or the legislature. I predict the legislature will drop the ball, because they always do, on reapportionment, and it's going to probably be Judge Dick doing it. And then it's going to probably be more odd districts with cultural communities of interest, like the district she liked in the hearing she had last year were ones where the Delta parishes were combined with Baton Rouge, and the witnesses said that it was appropriate because they listened to the same music and cheered the same sport teams. Now, that's community of interest, now the Delta and Baton Rouge. Landry and the state didn't even defend on those issues. The Fifth Circuit makes it clear that the district court found the state offered no evidence as to communities of interest in Louisiana. They just ignored the issue. Traditional redistricting criteria were ignored. So anyway, the point is, the judge has set a hearing. I don't know if she's going to do a scheduling order very soon. There will be a hearing, I think, in December. But we got to see what the legislature is going to do. You can talk to the governor this afternoon about the likelihood of whether he'll call a special session. But I'm suspecting it's going to go to Judge Dick, and there's going to be a court master appointed to do it. And I urge everybody to pay attention and go down to that hearing and take part in it.
All right. Let's get one more caller in for Mr. Wolf. Henry at the Country Club of Louisiana, you're on. And then we'll go to Paul Arrigo. Henry, good morning.
Well, good morning, Mr. Jim. Good morning, Mr. Wolf. Y'all talking about Garrett Graves, and those are certainly criticisms of him, which I agree with, but we also need to look at the bigger picture. Mr. Garrett Graves seems to have abandoned, and that's my term, the people in our congressional district, because he was trying to pad his own pocket or whatever with latching on to Kevin McCarthy and those Republicans. I think that the people here elected him, not the people up in Kevin McCarthy's district. Thank you all very much.
All right. Well, thank you, Henry. But he thought McCarthy was a better bet, I'm sure, than other Republican alternatives, including Scalise. And he may very well pay a price for doing that. And as I'm saying, you can take aim at Garrett Graves for having a district that is gerrymandered, which it is. But on this one, if he really thought Kevin McCarthy was the better choice, then he followed his conscience. And there is something to be said for somebody who does that at political risk, Mike.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. I don't have any complaint about his judgment on the House officers.
And McCarthy, the Democrats, you make a point. It looks like they're giving you said the Republicans are hypocrites. Well, the Democrats are giving Johnson more leeway than they gave McCarthy, aren't they? He got more Democratic votes yesterday than he did Republicans.
Yeah, he's getting a honeymoon. I guess they don't want to get crossways with the Lord.
Before we go, Robbie Hogan, the outstanding political science professor at LSU, he sent me this email saying he will not be near a phone, but he wants me to ask the governor this. And it's a legitimate question, but it's one that I think is a question not only for him, but for people who follow the world of politics as closely as you. It says, he wants me to ask, will you promise that you will not serve any corporate boards of companies that the executive branch regulated while you were governor? Is that a reasonable ask, or is that something that would be piling on to expect that of this governor and not have rules in place for previous governors who probably benefited from their associations to some extent after they left office.
Well, that makes me think of the ethics issues with the Supreme Court. Of course, there's a general ethics principle that you shouldn't benefit from your office, you know, after you leave it. But it's a complicated question. I would refer it to experts and would have to really think about it.
Okay. Thank you, Mike Wolf. Always good to talk with you. And now in the House is the man who for 20 years headed Visit Baton Rouge under a few different names, but like a rose. It's still a rose, and he did a fine job. Paul Arrigo, who is a New Orleanian through and through, but you decided to stay in Baton Rouge. Why did you decide?
I did. I have family up here. It's a great city to live. It's a great city to visit. And, you know, I lived for 10 or 11 years up in the Washington, D.C. area. It's also a great place. But I love Baton Rouge, and I can enjoy myself here, Jim. It's great to be retired, let me tell you. Everyone should do it once in their life.
Yeah. Do you still get to New Orleans?
I was in New Orleans this weekend, and I was very impressed. The city looked much better than I had expected, and I was really impressed.
It's still a magnificent place.
It is a world-class city, and I will tell you, Jim, it's not the same as it was when you and I were there. Of course, I was there longer than you, and I think a lot of it had to do with generationally what a great time it was to be a baby boomer, you know?
Yeah. We were both on Elysian Fields.
We were.
But, you know, for white kids in New Orleans, it was pretty good. But as we know, that city has a tragic history, too. It was the center of the biggest slave trade in the world, and that goes with the legacy. It's not all sunshine and roses, but
also the biggest lynching in American history when 9 Sicilians were lynched, and
that is
very
true.
Very seldom talked about.
Well, and it should be. And I saw the Advocate a few weeks ago actually reported on that, and hats off to them. But yeah, hasn't been good for Italians. And at one time, in the most prominent country club here in the Baton Rouge, not only blacks were excluded, but Italians as well. Are you a member, Paul?
No, I am not. I'm a member of the City Club, though, Jim, and I'm still a member. I'm a senior member of the City Club, and it's a
great place. That is a nice place, isn't it?
It really is. It's a great place to enjoy yourself and relax. Yes.
And it's right at the heart of the city.
Yes.
I'm a City Club kind of guy. I'm not a member, but maybe you can invite me. I don't think I'm going to be invited to the other place.
You can meet me there for breakfast. It's free. I know you like to go to Louie's where you
have... I do, but... But, you know, every now and then we got to walk on the wild side. And Paul Arrigo, if you're inviting me to breakfast, I'll be there.
And absolutely, you talk about walk on the wild side, Jim. As I was riding over here, it dawned on me that this weekend, I hope we wanted rain, but we didn't want this long. But this weekend, we've got white lights downtown.
Well, we'll talk about that. We'll talk with Paul after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. In-house is Paul Arrigo. He retired not so long ago as head of Visit Baton Rouge, and you have been very kind to your predecessor, or your successor, rather, your successor, and the show goes on without you and seems to be going pretty well without you.
Jill Kidder is doing an outstanding job. I'm so pleased that she has taken on the reins and moved Visit Baton Rouge into a new era, and it's a new era for destination marketing organizations becoming much more involved with advocacy, product development, what have you. I'm so happy about that move.
White light night, that's become a tradition in this community. If you go down Government Street, which is one of Mike Wolf's haunts, you're gonna see him and about 4,000 or 5,000 of his closest friends. It's quite an event, isn't it?
You know, we're all impressed with what has occurred in downtown, certainly under with Wendy's taken over and what Davis had done for many, many years and worked so closely with me. But Mid-City is, when I'm driving down Mid-City and I look at the restaurants and the bars and places like Circa, the antique store that draws people in from not only the region, from all over the country for their. I'm really impressed with so many things here in the city, Jim. I really am.
And you decided to stay, which I think is a benefit to us. And I fly out of Baton Rouge unless I have to fly out of New Orleans. And I see your pretty face right there on the board. Airport Commissioner Paul Arrigo. What does an airport commissioner do, Paul?
Well, we advise the staff on direction, budgeting, and marketing ideas. Of course, there is an authority, which is basically the Metro Council. I have been fortunate enough to be appointed to that through the Metro Council, unanimously, by the way, Jim. I was not unanimously selected as president of Visit Baton Rouge back in the day, but I'm so pleased to be on the Airport Commission, and I'm so proud of BTR. It is a well-run airport, and I'm so glad to have it here in Baton Rouge.
Yeah, it has about 1/12 the traffic of New Orleans, though, and right now there's concern that the flight to Washington may have to be scrapped. Can that be salvaged?
Yeah, I talked to Mike Edwards yesterday because I knew that question would come up, and I knew through our meetings with the staff that they're going to be moving the time of that flight, I believe, from 6:30 to 7 a.m., which will help a little bit. You know, what really concerns me, Jim, is that we've got a great airport here, a convenient airport, an inexpensive airport, certainly to park. Yet there are people who feel that the three-hour to-and-from ride to New Orleans, the search for parking, the additional cost associated with a flight out of New Orleans, for some reason, is this love affair. And we need to get beyond that. We really do.
Well, unless you're going to save a whole lot of time on a direct flight, it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense to get in your car and drive, even though it's on the outskirts of New Orleans. But it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to do that.
And unless, you know, you're going to, and I understand this love affair that so many people have with a low-cost airline down there, but unless you're going to be paying out of your pocket and traveling with four kids, I mean, you and I, to fly out of New Orleans as opposed to Baton Rouge, and I do it when my brother and I go to LSU games, we fly out of Baton Rouge because of the time and the cost associated. It is cheaper to fly out of BTR.
It is. There's no question. And if you go to a place like Atlanta, which, of course, is a great city, you get there in an hour. You get there as fast as it takes to drive to New Orleans.
Right. That's right.
And you're there. Mm-hmm. And it's generally not as expensive when you travel out of Baton Rouge. So I'm a big Baton Rouge Airport supporter. I think it's one of the real good entities. But a listener asked a good point. With this train that's in the offing right now, the schedule that I see is that there's a stop at the New Orleans mm-hmm. airport, but there's no stop at the Baton Rouge airport. Will that perhaps cause a problem with air traffic diminishing in Baton Rouge?
Well, here's my disclaimer, Jim. I'm here as Paul Arrigo's citizen, although I am a member of the commission and I'm past president CEO of Visit Baton Rouge. Connecting a world class, an international class city like Baton Rouge and New Orleans and Baton Rouge, I think it is nice. It's cool. I don't know whether we looked at the impact that's going to be associated with that, the impact on Baton Rouge Airport, because we're told, oh, you could be at Moisant in an hour and a half was the term. You know, you can go down there and shop. You can go down there and have great food. You can entertainment, like you were down for the show. What impact is it having? And for a city that has a fetish for studies, why haven't we done a study on the impact, the economic impact on Baton Rouge, if in fact this comes about? And it looks like the train's going to come about, and I'm happy about it. I think it's going to connect the two cities. I just am a little disappointed that there has been no discussion in regard to the possible negative economic impact.
Well, I think more people in Baton Rouge are likely to go to New Orleans because it is one of the great entertainment meccas of the world than people in New Orleans. Or people in New Orleans come to Baton Rouge for business or family. They rarely come for pleasure. That's just a fact.
People in New Orleans, and I'm a New Orleanian, will go to Biloxi. They'll go to Las Vegas. They'll go to Destin and what have you, Sandestin, but I agree 100%.
Although a listener correctly notes, they do come for LSU football.
And if the train runs the way it is, they'll probably go back the same night, and I'm wondering if what impact that'll have. But I'm not here to talk.
Well, they ought to make it such that at least they have to spend a night.
I would think so. Yeah, you know? And let me tell you something. Some of those games go on long enough, for heaven knows, you know.
You know what? Dale Brown called me, and he was on the road to New Orleans. And he says, this is the strangest phenomenon I've ever seen. I'm driving to New Orleans, and there's no traffic on my side, and it's just back-to-back traffic the other way. I said, he says, what's going on? I said, well, LSU's playing tonight, coach. He says, people from New Orleans actually come to the games. I said, oh, yeah. I think they're crazier about the Tigers in New Orleans than they are in Baton Rouge. And if you have a little bit of distance, sometimes that makes a difference.
Yeah, and isn't it exciting, Jim, that Tulane's having such a good year and LSU's having such a good year and that, you know, college football is doing well.
Well, Tulane, for 2 years running now, may very well finish ahead of LSU in the polls. They did last year, and you're right. Willie Fritz gets no respect, and he's making, like, I don't know, a tenth of what Brian Kelly's making?
Well, maybe he'll go to A&M. You never can tell.
Well, let's hope not. Let's hope not. He's a good coach.
Yeah, he certainly is.
But I think LSU and Tulane should play every year.
That would be fun. Of course, you and I go back to the days when it was, and I remember when Tulane beat LSU was the first time in 25 years.
1973. We're coming up on the 50th anniversary, December 1st, and that'll be a Friday. We want to have John Berry on, the Rising Tide author. You know, he was an assistant coach to Benny Ellender that staff. 1973.
Was it Benny Ellender or was it Gibson?
It was Benny Ellender in 73. Okay. It was Vince Gibson in 80, 81 when Tulane won 48-7 in the Superdome, and then in 82 when they upset LSU 31-28 in Baton Rouge.
Right after we beat Florida State, I believe.
55-21, yeah.
Jim, you are amazing with dates and scores, and I'll tell you what, I do chide occasionally when I see our mutual friend. You know, Jerry Stovall never beaten Tulane, except as a player.
Well, he lost, let's see, he beat him in 1980. He did beat him his first year. He did.
Okay, well, my mistake.
But he lost in 81, 82, and he beat him in 83. He beat him twice. He was 2-2.
Well, yeah, you would know better than I.
But you know in 82, or 81 rather, when Tulane won 48-7 in New Orleans, and this shows you
why. I was there.
Yeah, I was there too, and this shows you the kind of hate that I think is good, but it got out of control. Tulane not only took great satisfaction in beating LSU by 41 points, several of the students came to Baton Rouge that night, and they let Mike out of the cage.
You're kidding.
And it took 13 police officers to shoot him down, you know, knock him out, and then put him on some kind of a gurney and get him back into his cage. Fortunately, nobody was hurt, but that could have been a dangerous situation if you confronted Mike the Tiger on Nicholson Drive where he was found.
It might have been the end of having a live tiger as a mascot, I can tell you.
But they don't bring him to the games anymore, which is a real downer.
I'm sure the PETA people had something to do with that.
Well, and remember in the old days, too, his cage was about the size of this studio, and now the only tiger with a greater habitat than this one is Tiger Woods.
It is a beautiful. And by the way, our research when I was with this Baton Rouge indicated that Mike the Tiger was the number one visited quote attraction by out of town people.
Yeah, that's what Mark Emmert said when he got the money to spruce up the cage. It is a great habitat. You can go by and say hello to Mike, and he looks like he needs to get on a fitness plan. He's starting to pack on the pounds, but we don't want him to expire too soon.
And will you say that to everybody, Jim? You know that, including me.
Well, Mike the Tiger is an institution in Louisiana. It would be nice to have him at the games again. And he used to roar at the visitors' locker room. Remember that?
Yes, he did. If I recall, the cheerleaders would beat on occasion. They might have been a battery attached to that and give him a little bit of a jolt. But I missed that, too, and I distinctly remember when it was driven around by, at one time, a Ford, then it became a pickup truck, sure.
Well, in a listener notes, getting to Mike Wolfe, who's a Stanford graduate, that Tiger Woods, the aforementioned Tiger, went to Leland Stanford University, LSU, so that makes him an LSU Tiger.
There you go. And if I recall, University of the South also is, are the purple and gold Tigers, is that right?
Yeah, we went through that, yeah.
Yes, we did.
Sewanee, right?
That's right. And a former member of the SEC.
Former member of the SEC.
Sure.
Well, it's always a pleasure. It's been too long. We need to bring you back soon and very soon. Paul Arrigo, congrats on kind of retirement.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks for listening. Stay tuned.